You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Rit Premnath. Rit, thanks so much for being with me today.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Rit, let's talk about some of your current projects or what you're working on now. There's a number of things I'd like to talk about, but let's just begin with what is it that you're working on right now?
Sure. I'm working on a couple of things right now. I just finished kind of a large piece for the Queen's Museum somewhat recently, and it was part of a show that was looking at two generations of Indian art, modernism and contemporary Indian art. And I did a piece that dealt with the relationship between property ownership and occupation, which is something that I've been interested in a little while. It was an interest that began when thinking about Bangalore, the city in India where I'm from. It was a city that started off as a very small, sleepy little town, but grew very quickly because of the IT industry into quite a large metropolis. And so the cost of real estate is extremely expensive, but the people who build it have almost nothing to live on. And so then thinking about that and thinking about the relation to something like Occupy Wall Street in New York and the importance of staking one's physical position and space and claiming it as a right that supersedes the ownership of space is a kind of political position. And so that's something that has interested me, and so the work at the Queen's Museum was looking at those conceptual issues using photographs. One of the photographs was of a construction laborer sleeping at a construction site in Dubai, a migrant laborer from India, and the other was a series of sculptural pieces that more kind of metaphorically deal with this issue. They're made out of they look like sheets of sand that are approximately human-sized, approximately my size, about 2 feet wide by 6 feet long, and they kind of slump on architectural forms, and they're titled Slump. And so I kind of work through these themes in, at times, semi-documentary fashion, and at times in a much more abstract, metaphorical fashion.
Right, and both of those examples sounds like they shows both. And one, the sculptures are somewhat they are abstract and as you say metaphorical. And the photographs were, in fact, more documentary. It's hard to imagine like what exactly was in those photographs.
So one of the pieces is made up of these leaning sheets of corrugated plastic that's used as a roofing material, and it has layers of one image, and that image is of this sleeping migrant construction laborer. So the photograph is directly applied onto the corrugated board, and then it's torn, and then another photograph is applied on top of it, and so it looks like how you would imagine posters on a wall in the street that has been pasted on and torn off and a new poster placed on top of it. And so there is an image that I'm working through in that piece that is very specific, but at the same time it takes on a kind of sculptural quality because it's applied onto this, it's torn and applied onto this corrugated plastic. And there's another piece in that same show which uses two images, one of which, and both of which are very site-specific, I would say. One is, because the show was at the Queen's Museum, one is of the India Pavilion at the 1964 New York World's Fair, and the other is a large billboard that I shot in 2014 from Bangalore that says New York Living in Bangalore. And it was kind of interesting to me that on the one hand, the government of India presented this pavilion in New York with a kind of idea of what India or Indianness or modern India would look like to the rest of the world. And on the other hand, Indians living in India right now in a city like Bangalore think of themselves as living as if they're in New York. And so what does that kind of spatial displacement mean? And so again, there are two specific documentary photographs that are being used, but they're applied kind of on top of each other, and you're looking through each through the other, and they have this kind of sculptural quality, but also a sort of documentary quality to them.
It's very interesting, and what was the 1964 exhibit like? What was, I mean, I always found that World's Fair and documents of it so fascinating. What was the pavilion looking like then? What did they imagine in 1964 modern India would look like?
It was an interesting moment, I think, in India's history, because Indira Gandhi, the first woman president of India, was the person in power at the time, and she had this kind of she was very aligned with the Soviet Union and had this idea of a kind of modern India that would be this place of equality in terms of gender, in terms of class, sort of a proto-socialist kind of equality, but one, unlike the Soviet Union, one that was very much still Indian in its kind of aesthetic look and feel. And so the pavilion was this very, it was designed by an architect, and it featured kind of both historic and modern fabric and ceramic and kind of household designs, as well as somewhat new technologies. But it looked like this idea of a kind of modern India, but not an India that had left behind its history of aesthetics. It was kind of, it still had this look that one could very easily say was Indian. And so the whole building, like each of these pavilions, was a kind of expensive structure that was built specifically for the World's Fair. And some of these pavilions have remained as permanent structures, but the India Pavilion doesn't exist anymore. But it's quite interesting because there's a small publication that they put out at the time of the World's Fair, which is a conversation between Indira Gandhi and Robert Moses, where she says that it's a kind of for the groundbreaking ceremony, and she says, despite the fact that India is just starting out as a new country post-independence, just two decades out of after colonialism, we don't really have the money to be doing something like this, but we still feel that it's very important for us to project an image out into the world. And so we are taking this on as an expenditure at a time when there are greater needs in the country. And so it's quite interesting that at a time like that, the prime minister of the country would actually come to New York and speak during the World's Fair. But yeah, which is something that I was interested in, this kind of anxiety, which I think is still very much a part of India and something that I think about quite a bit in my work, which is this contradiction, let's say, between an idea of Indian identity and an idea of global identity. And it's always being thought out, I think, in Indian politics and aesthetics.
It's really a fascinating idea of, you know, what Indira Gandhi was proposing. That sounds extraordinarily ahead of its time. I mean, you know, even in terms of the 60s, you know, wanting in America, wanting a kind of equality among people, or to some degree, which in a sense failed in this country in the 60s. There wasn't that kind of gender equality or a number of things that you just mentioned that the Indian Pavilion was proposing. I mean, don't you think that's kind of, and especially her talk with Robert Moses, it seems you know, like it must have been one of the pavilions that was the most advanced in terms of ideal thinking about societies, I would think.
Yeah, no, I think it's a fascinating moment, really, because she, in interviews, there's actually a very famous interview with an American radio journalist, makes that very comment that you're making, which is that in many ways she feels that the Soviet Union is much more advanced in terms of gender equality than the U.S., and that for that reason she feels that India should follow in that direction. And but then, I mean, this is a very fraught thing because even though it seems so prescient in 1964, it's still an issue that India is actively dealing with even now and hasn't fully come to terms with it. So we had a woman prime minister, but that in no way has affected the fact that gender equality is still an issue in 2016, you know, or 15. So,
And how was the response to that show? Did it create some conversations, or was there a reaction to it that you can discuss? Or I'm kind of wondering how even the audience or curators engage in those ideas, because it is those kind of notions or ideas we don't see presented very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting problem. It's something that Holland Cotter, who writes for the New York Times, talks about a lot, which is that he feels that shows that are dealing with cultural or historical issues that are not familiar to a predominantly kind of Euro-American audience often go kind of uncommented on, because critics don't feel equipped to deal with those histories, and so they just don't. And I think it was quite inspiring to hear him talk about how he felt that he is a sort of professional amateur, and that he knows that he is not an expert on every subject, but he makes a fair attempt. He does as much research as he can, and then writes reviews. And so Holland wrote a review of the show. The Wall Street Journal did a review of the show, and I think it was an art form review. But in many ways, it was a really interesting and important show that I feel like didn't really get the kind of attention that it could or should have. But I feel like it's something
That's interesting, again, because of cultural context and cultural bias, or naivete in a sense.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's a tricky thing. It's something that I find myself dealing with quite often, in part because I'm based here. I've spent almost half my life in the U.S., and my work at times deals with issues that have to do with India or histories that are elsewhere, and at other times my work deals with, you know, for like philosophy, and I've been interested in Ludwig Wittgenstein for a while, and his writings have entered into my practice quite a bit. And so there are ways in which when I do a show, even back in India, it isn't always read the way I want it to be read. And in fact, I did a show a few years ago called Plot that took up these same issues around, in an abstract way again, but these issues around property ownership and the occupation of space and kind of thinking about the body of the laborer. And so I've been thinking about Bangalore, and the show was in Bangalore, but I'd made all my work in New York. And when I had the show in Bangalore, I don't think people really got it or were able to read the work. And so I feel like there's always a certain degree of, shall we say, translation or illegibility that is part of this, of being maybe bicultural, or maybe it's a reality of living in a kind of global society now, that we're all always encountering things that are partially illegible to us.
Yeah, that's. I think that's true in so many cultures. I was just interviewing a curator and patron, really, about Middle Eastern art, and you know, she was talking about still the kind of complete misunderstanding of a lot of art that's coming out of the Middle East because of a misperception of what's happening there politically and socially. Let's talk a little bit about the ongoing project for Archive of the Future.
And Archive of the Future Interior, it's something that Tom Donovan, who's a poet based in New York, and a friend of mine and I started several years ago. It's actually it started as this idea that we would interview people about projects that they had planned to do but had not completed, that had remained in this kind of future anterior tense of this will have been, but has not yet happened. And we kind of had imagined creating this archive that would, we thought of it as a kind of time capsule that when people listen to these interviews that we had done, they would potentially open up possibilities of a project that had not yet been done but one could imagine doing. But that project has become a bit dormant, and in the meanwhile, I have a longer kind of standing project for the past, I founded a publication called Shifter in 2004, right out of undergrad, and so that has been ongoing, and we're working on the 22nd issue right now, which is called Dictionary of the Possible, and in some ways, it's a project that has a similar thrust, I would say, to the Archive of the Future Anterior, in that we meet as a group, we as in it's a kind of, there's two of us, Avi Alpert and I, who convene discussions every 2 weeks at Parsons, because I teach here. And it's usually friends, people who are academic, who are artists, who are poets, who come together to discuss one keyword every 2 weeks, and two people co-present the word, and we have a discussion around it, and this will result in a small publication called The Dictionary of the Possible that will be a little dictionary of sorts that will contain words that are, we feel, culturally significant that we want to think about more. And so that's the project that I've been working on for the last little more than a year. And we'll finish our year and a half discussion series at the end of, in the beginning of December, and hope to publish the new issue of Shifter maybe in January or March. So,
yes, it's a great project. I'd like to talk a little bit more about that. Because it was, it's so long running now. How was that founded? How did the beginning of that start? And what were your goals at the beginning?
The goals have I guess shifted and changed as I have. But when I began the project, I just started grad school at Bard, and between my first and second summer at Bard, I returned to India to visit my parents, but didn't get a visa to come back. And so I was in India for a year in between, and it was a very anxiety-provoking year. And during that time, I met a lot of artists in Bangalore who I had never met before because I'd studied, I came to the U.S. to do my undergrad, and so I had a whole group of friends, artists in the U.S., and then I had met a whole set of new people in India and Bangalore, and I wanted to create an online platform that was not in any way culturally specific, but that would be driven thematically. And it would be a platform where friends from these two different places could coexist in an intellectual kind of discursive space. And so Shifter began as this online publication that was thematic.
And somewhere along the way in 2000, in the 10th issue, which was probably maybe 6 or 7, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I decided to start making a print version of the publication. And eventually when I started co-editing the publication with Matthew Metzger, who's a painter based in Chicago, we felt in many ways that even though this had begun as an online publication, neither of us actually looked at other online publications, and we both really liked physical books. And so we decided to make it a print-only publication. And so from issue, I think it was like issue 15 onwards, Shifter has been only print and no free PDF. So it's kind of changed over time. And then after the last issue, after issue number 21, I felt like the thing that I most enjoyed about this project, because it's not a project that actually makes any money. I actually call it a one step below not for profit. It's a for loss kind of like art practice, I guess. And so I felt like the thing that I enjoyed most about this process of making a publication was the editorial process of actually speaking well and interacting with another person's contribution. And I wanted to extend that period of time and reduce the time that I spent, you know, inviting people and publishing and trying to distribute. And so this new issue, the Dictionary of the Possible, became a way to foreground the process of conversation and dialogue. And we have a shared Google Doc that anyone who comes to the conversation is added to. And we collaboratively edit this document, which will then turn into the publication. And so in a way, it's created a kind of big community that that of people who either come once or a small core group that comes every time. And I think that's kind of what I wanted. I want this discursive intellectual space that is not part of my art practice, which is very much a studio practice, nor is it part of my teaching, job, work. And it's a sort of extracurricular educational space that friends, students, that whoever wants to really can come and join.
I mean, I really love that idea, and, you know, I relate to it in a way just because it reminds me of some of my intentions with this series of interviews. Isn't it also a kind of, I don't want to use the term networking, but it's this collaborative idea. You're working with a lot of other artists, and that in itself builds a type of community or interactive group, so to speak, because it's, you know, your practice is also a kind of, you know, separate entity. But at the same time, you're engaging the whole art world in this, or different people, different intellectuals, different artists in this publication. Do you find it also is a type of community builder, if for lack of a better word? I feel like I'm not saying the right word, but, you know.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think even that, or the way that has worked, has changed over time. When I first moved to New York and I was doing Shifter, it was a way for me to meet people in an interesting way, you know, so I could invite them to be in an issue that related to the practice, and then maybe we meet for coffee and we talk, and then I have a new friend. And so initially it really was a way that I got to know a lot of people in New York who have been in friends, who have become collaborators, who, in fact, a very close friend of mine, the way we met was I invited him to be in Shifter, and he counter-invited me to be in an exhibition, because it turned out that he was curating a show that had almost exactly the same theme,
Yusuf Shifter that I was editing, and so and we've remained friends since. But and now I find myself in a kind of different place in my life, but I still find it really important to foster an intellectual community, because I feel like oftentimes the art world doesn't really encourage it. There's a sort of competitiveness and a wariness about each other, and most studio visits with gallerists or curators is not a kind of active engagement. It's a kind of voyeurism of someone coming in to see what you're doing and deciding whether or not to fit into their agenda. And so it feels very important for me to create the kind of intellectual space that I want, and that actually helps my work, and I think it also helps the work of other people who join the community. So it is the kind of community building, and as you said, at least initially, it was also a form of networking.
I like the way you put it, because it's true. The art world, you know, seems encourages, you know, if not direct competitiveness, a kind of isolated way of working. Artists are in their studios in all different places, and there isn't these kind of open lines of not just, you know, communication, but really interaction and respect for one another. I really love that idea of doing it together, and it seems its longevity says something to the fact of how rich an experience it must be for all participants, as well as people who are just viewers or readers.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's also this, I think like an art practice, a lot of it really just has to do with commitment and sticking around and doing it and doing it again and doing it again, because even with Shifter, it really took about 10 issues for people to take notice of it. And for people to realize that it even existed, you know? And I feel like a lot of artists begin publications, and it very quickly kind of peters out, because it's hard to sustain. It's just a lot of work. But I think if you kind of are committed to it and keep going, it really does pay off in a big way. And really helps, I think, create a kind of serious community that, and a kind of discursive way around which my work is viewed. So people think of my practice both as Shifter and as a kind of art practice, and those two things influence each other, and the way each one is read through the other, I think.
I like that. Rit, before we go, there'll be links in this interview to perhaps some projects of yours or websites. Is there anywhere else, because this interview will be up most likely in the month of November 2015, is there anything you want to point the listening audience to or draw their attention to in terms of places to see your work or anything else?
Sure. I'm in a group show at the Logan Center in Chicago, which opens next week. And I'm going to be doing a reading during the opening. And so that's one place where my work will be soon. And I was also selected for a commission for Art Dubai in March. So I'll be doing a new project for Art Dubai. So I don't know if any of your listeners will find themselves in UAE, but they can see my work there as well.
Rit, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been fascinating to me.
Thank you so much for having me on again.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with The Art World Demystified.